Okay, so I'm going to pick up very much where we left off, where we started talking about Hilbert and the work that he was doing and how that relates to what Einstein was doing when he was working on his gravitational theory. So obviously the reason we're here in 2015 doing this is because it's 100 years since the publication of the final form of the Einstein field equations. And I want to take that as the sort of point of intersection between between what Hilbert was doing and what Einstein was doing. And I'll talk about what Hilbert was doing prior to the publication of the Einstein field equations and what he was doing afterwards. And sort of by moving outwards from this point of intersection, we can see the process of physical theorizing that's going on. And one reason I wanted to say this explicitly is because I take it, having some guests on the basis of who was speaking at this conference, just to make explicit, one of the things that's clear from the kind of work that we do is that rather than taking a theory and looking at that and sort of philosophizing about it as an object, the philosophical action is really in the process of physical theorizing. This is where the interesting stuff is going on. So here's the outline of my talk. First of all, I just want to put a few preliminaries on the table to set us up. And then I'll talk about Hilbert's background in thinking about physics, and in particular his axiomatic method, the way that he was using that and applying it in the case of physics. Then I'll talk about his discussion of general covariance, causality, and energy conservation, and their interrelations prior to the publication of Einstein's field equations, and then his discussion about these three things post the field equations, and then wrap up at the end. So this very much picks up on exactly where we left off just before lunch. Okay, so some preliminaries first, just to put a few things on the table. So as many of you know in this room know, in the summer of 1915, Einstein went to Göttingen, where Hilbert was, and he spent a week there and gave a series of lectures while he was there. And it's very clear that Einstein and Hilbert hit it off pretty well, both for their conversations in physics, but also more generally. So here's a couple of quotes from letters that Einstein wrote just after he'd left Göttingen. So he's wrote, "I was in Göttingen for a week where I met him, i.e. Hilbert, and became quite fond of him. I held 6 2-hour lectures there on gravitation theory, which is now clarified very much already, and had the pleasure of convincing the mathematicians there thoroughly. Berlin is no match for Göttingen as far as the liveliness of the academic interest is concerned." And then he writes to Sommerfeld, "In Göttingen I had the great pleasure of seeing that everything was understood down to the details. I'm quite enchanted with Hilbert. That's an important man for you." Okay, so they hit it off. And after Einstein's visit, Hilbert was clearly inspired by these lectures of Einstein's and the conversations that they had. And he set to work on a project that involved gravitation and generally covariant field equations. And the things that I want to just focus in on for the purposes of my talk today and our conversation is these three elements that I already mentioned that are in common between Einstein's search for a new theory of gravitation and that can also be found in Hilbert's project. So general covariance, causality, and energy conservation, and the relations between them. So presumably Einstein talked about these things in his lectures in the summer of 1915 and told one story about it, but I think we can say that Hilbert had a different way of thinking about these things and the relationship between them, and that's what I want to talk about. Okay, so as we're going to see, by the time that Einstein visited Göttingen in the summer of 1915, Hilbert already had a long history of interest in physics and of engagement with physics, and he had his own well-worked-out approach to tackling physics, which had its own goals and motivations. So given that background, one thing we can ask is, okay, so what did Hilbert learn from this period, from this visit, from Einstein? And crucially, one of the things that happened is that Hilbert became convinced that in seeking a generally covariant theory of gravitation, Einstein had uncovered a profound epistemological insight, even though, as we talked about this morning, at the time, Einstein himself believed that no generally covariant theory could be physically acceptable. Hilbert built this insight of general covariance into the axioms of his theory and then went on to explore the connections between general covariance, causality, and energy conservation. So that's just some background. And now I want to go through this and fill in some details about what it was that Hilbert was up to. Okay, so a little bit then about his background in physics. By the time that Einstein visited, Hilbert had been lecturing and teaching seminars in physics pretty much every year for almost 20 years. And this has been documented by Leo Corey. So he's teaching on a range of subjects. He's teaching with a variety of people. He's covering different topics within physics. And within this teaching that he's doing, he is teaching about, this includes the application of his axiomatic method to physics. So familiar with this idea from his work in geometry. But what I want to talk about is the way that he applies this in the context of physics, what it is he thinks he's trying to do with respect to physics. And the only point I want to make here now is that he's already thinking about physics in this way sometime before Einstein visits Göttingen. So already in 1905, for example, 10 years earlier, he has a series of lectures that's titled Axiomatization of Physical Theories, and this includes a variety of topics again, so mechanics, thermodynamics, probability, kinetic theory of gases, electrodynamics, and so on. Okay, so this is the context into which within which we should think about the work that he does in 1915. So it's in the context of this long history of interest in physics. But one thing we want to know, if we're going to make any progress in understanding what Hilbert was trying to do, is we need to know a bit more about what on earth is his axiomatic method. So here's a summary of what it is. It's a way of thinking about a field of study, a way of thinking about an area of physics. And the idea is that you begin in intuition, you begin with our experience of the world, and then we organize that experience by means of concepts. And as we organize that conceptual structure, what we're trying to get to is a system of mathematical axioms that he says have to be simple and general and possess three properties of mutual consistency, independence, and completeness. So this is the first step, is to try and get ourselves to a position in which we can axiomatize our theory. And then we have to investigate the logical consequences of the axioms. We have to make our way back towards experience. So we have to investigate the logical consequences of the axioms. And what's really crucial for Hilbert's, the way that Hilbert's trying to investigate physical theories, is what he's trying to do is separate out the contributions of experience from the things that we can deduce from the logical axioms. So that deductions, that what we deduce from our axioms, we shouldn't be helping ourselves in any way to experience on the way down in making those deductions. We have to do it purely looking at the logical consequences of these axioms. So we do this, but we're not done once we've deduced those consequences. The significance of our results depends on being able to relate them back to intuition. And so we've got ourselves to our axioms, we deduce the consequences, and then we have to understand those consequences in the context of our experience of the world. And if there's any kind of conflict or tension between those, then we have to resolve them. So from this brief overview, the thing that you're supposed to take away from this is the flavour of this, which is that this is a use of logical tools to investigate a project, and it's an epistemological project. It's about different ways in which we know the world, the way that we know the world through our experience of the world, and also the conceptual structures by which we think about the world. And Hilbert uses this phrase of deepening the foundations repeatedly. You see him using this phrase over and over again. I want to deepen the foundations of physics, and the way that we're going to do that is to understand, is to see how we can separate out the stuff that comes from our experience of the world and the stuff that comes from the logical structure of the theory. We want to see if we can cleanly separate these to understand, to better understand our theory. So that's something by way of the axiomatic method. Let's see how that works out in practice in the fall of 1915. So second part of what I wanted to talk about is his discussion of general covariance, causality, and energy conservation and their interrelations prior to the publication of Einstein's field equations. And for this, the sort of key text is Hilbert's first communication on the foundations of physics from November of that year. But we don't know what he said in that presentation. All we have is the publication from March 1916, so from after the publication of the field equations. But then, crucially, in addition to this, we have the proofs of that first communication from December 1915, and this is something that John Stapshall, Jürgen Renn, and Leo Corey wrote about in 1997 following Corey's discovery of these December proofs. And these are really important because there are important differences between the proofs and the published version, and these give us some indication of what Hilbert may have talked about back in November of 1915. So that's the kind of crucial bit of evidence that we have for how he was thinking at the time. And he's trying to apply his axiomatic method. And his suggestion is that he's going to see what follows, what the consequences are, what the logical consequences are of adopting, and these are the first two axioms that he puts forward in this first communication. So first of all, he specifies what his Lagrangian is going to depend on. So it's going to depend on the metric, the first derivative and the second derivative of the metric, and then on the electromagnetic field and its first derivative. So we're just going to stipulate that that's what our Lagrangian depends on. So we look at what the physicists are doing. Seems like this is what we're going to need. We're going to need a metric field, and we're going to need something from electromagnetism with that kind of dependence. So that's going to be our first axiom taken from physics. And then the second axiom, he's very clear about this, is his axiom of general invariance. Once the terminology stabilizes, what we mean by general covariance. So we take these two axioms, and then we just see what follows from them. And according to Hilbert, what follows, the core of what's going on in the first communication are two sets of consequences. First of all, consequences for electromagnetism, and secondly, an underdetermination problem. And it's the second problem that we'll focus on, but I want to just talk briefly about this first set of consequences first. So, as you see, he puts into the Lagrangian that we're going to have the metric and its derivatives and the electromagnetic potential. And he says, given general covariance, if we impose general covariance on our Lagrangian, then what's going to follow from this is strong restrictions on the form of the electromagnetic part of the theory, which follow as a consequence of the structure of the gravitational part of the theory. And I'll say a little bit more about that in a minute. Then the second consequence, which, as I said, is the one I really want to focus on, is his theorem one, the leitmotif of his theory. He says, if axiom two is satisfied, then there'll be an underdetermination problem in the theory. Only 14 independent equations, only 10 independent equations, but the 14 potentials postulated in axiom one. So we'll say a little bit more about that as well in a second. But first, a bit more about the consequences for electromagnetism. So Hilbert says, in the sense indicated, electrodynamic phenomena are effects of gravitation. So what does he mean by that? As we saw, he's means that if you take these two axioms, then we're going to get two things. First of all, that the gravitational equations entail four mutually independent linear combinations of the electromagnetic equations and their first derivatives. Michelle Janssen mentioned earlier that coming up in a couple of years, in 3 years, is Noether's second theorem. This is an instance of Noether's second theorem of the mutual dependencies of the Euler expressions for the different fields that you've got appearing in your Lagrangian. And Hilbert says, this is the exact mathematical expression of the above generally stated assertion concerning the character of electrodynamics as an accompanying phenomenon of gravitation. And this result was hugely important for Hilbert. If you think about the kind of project that he's engaged with, one of the things that's of interest to him is a kind of unification project, a kind of bringing together of as much as physics under a single system as possible, axiomatized system as possible. So for him, the fact that you can get out this mutual dependency or this dependence of electromagnetic phenomena on the gravitational field equations was something that was very important for him. A second aspect of this is that given these axioms, you get the kind of gauge structure of electromagnetism. So I don't want to spend too much time on this, but I do want to mention it because it's just an illustration of the kind of project that he has underway, that he's trying to investigate what the logical structure of any theory would be that satisfied general covariance. So let's turn our attention now to the aspect of the proofs that has more to do with the theme that I wanted to talk about, so covariance, causality, and energy conservation. So, given the first two axioms, theorem one, as we saw, says that If the axiom of general covariance is satisfied, then there'll be an underdetermination problem in the theory. Only 10 independent equations for the 14 potentials. And this is what connects general covariance with the problem of causality for Hilbert. So for Hilbert, the causality problem associated with general covariance just is this underdetermination problem, this issue that given general covariance, you're going to have less equations than you've got unknowns in your theory. And this, I think, is going to be perhaps a point of disagreement, lead to a point of disagreement between Michelle Janssen and me in terms of how you think about what Hilbert was doing at the time. So both Einstein and Hilbert argue from general covariance as some kind of causality problem. But I want to say that Hilbert's causality problem just isn't the same as Einstein's in his whole argument. And just how they're thinking about it is importantly different in interesting ways. So for Hilbert, the problem is a purely mathematical technical result following from general covariance. So it's just this issue of the underdetermination in the field equations. So here the problems are different, but this difference goes by fairly quickly in the paper because Hilbert, in wanting to resolve this underdetermination, to give us equations that, given a Cauchy surface, you can evolve things forward determinately, draws on energy conservation, which clearly I think he must have been taking from Einstein. So here comes the connection to energy conservation. So, as we heard about this morning, what Einstein does is to impose four non-generally covariant conditions that ensure energy conservation, and thereby restrict the class, the covariance class of the field equations that he's working with. Whereas what happens with Hilbert is he starts with, he's got his generally covariant field equations, and what he wants to do within that structure is to extract a Cauchy determinant structure from within that. So he imposes the four non-generally covariant conditions that ensure energy conservation. He uses those in order to add some extra conditions such that you can get your unique evolution going, get your determinism going. And this is something that we know we need to do. You have to impose conditions such that you can get your unique evolution going. So Hilbert's energy conservation law consists of four non-generally covariant equations that he says complete the system of fundamental equations of physics. So in that sense, it's right that his fundamental equations of physics are not generally covariant. On the other hand, if you look at the way that this is implemented for Hilbert, you do start first of all with your Lagrangian, then you impose general covariance, from that you get your field equations. And then what you need to do beyond that, having recognized that those field equations won't give you a unique evolution, as a mathematical result, we're not worrying about the physical results, this is just an issue of the mathematical structure of your theory, we need to put some extra conditions on to get to be able to solve our equations. Okay, so that's prior to the publication of Einstein's field equations. Then in December, we get those field equations, and so the question is, how does that impact on what Hilbert thought he was doing? What changes come about in the wake of the publication of Einstein's field equations? And to answer that question, we need to draw on some additional resources. So in addition to the first communication, as we said, was the proofs were from December 1915 and the publication from early 1916. There's also a second communication. And apparently this was also presented in early December. There was another presentation in the beginning of 1916, in late February 1916. But we don't know what was in those. So both were withdrawn from publication, neither of them survived. And all we have is the published version, which comes from way later, from the beginning of 1917. So that's the information that we have to draw on. We have the proofs and the publication of the first communication and the later publication of the second communication. So there are other resources too, but these are the main things to draw on. And this second communication continues the same themes that were set up in the first communication. So again, what Hilbert makes use of is his axiomatic method. And again, he uses this to try and diagnose his problem of the problem of causality that he sees to be connected with general covariance, and then to try and find some resolution of that problem of causality. By the time of the second communication, he splits the problem of causality into two. You have the original underdetermination problem, and he also adds another one, which I'll mention in a minute. But his resolution has to be different, because he can no longer help himself to these non-generally covariant energy conservation conditions from Einstein. So obviously they've gone. Okay. So the first problem that he of causality that he talks about in his second communication is a problem of causal order. And here's what he says. A conflict with the causal order will arise if two world points lying along the same time-like curve and standing in the relation of cause and effect can be transformed so that they become simultaneous. If the new physics, the generally covariant physics, is to be compatible with the experienced causal ordering of events, we need to restrict the allowed coordinate systems such that under a coordinate transformation, any time-like curve remains a time-like curve. Call such coordinate transformations proper. And then the concepts of cause and effect lying at the basis of the principle of causality never lead to inner contradiction as soon as we restrict ourselves to the use of proper space-time coordinates. So we can worry about various things to do with this argument. The only thing that I want to take us to take away from that this really at the moment is this introduction of so-called proper space-time coordinates. So the idea is that we experience the world as being a causally ordered world, and that a generally covariant theory won't necessarily have this causal ordering in it. You can worry about that if you like. And so what we need to do is have these proper coordinate systems, which will take from that generally covariant structure and allow us to extract the world as we experience it. That's the work that that's going to do for us. So let's go on to see how he uses that with respect to the problem of underdetermination. So this is the same problem that he had back in the first communication. It's just this problem of not having enough equations for your unknowns. And he says, here's what we need to do. We need to separate out the world as we conceptualize it through our theory and the world as we experience it, and think again, just rethink what we mean, what it is for something to be physically meaningful. So first of all, we're going to say that there must be, so for a proposition to be physically meaningful, it has to have a generally covariant formulation, but that's not enough. General covariance by itself is not enough as a condition of physical meaningfulness. Also, because we have to pay attention to our experience of the world, not just how we conceptualize the world in our theories, when expressed with respect to a proper coordinate system, the truth value of the description has to be uniquely determined by an appropriate space-like past hypersurface. So we have to recover the determinism of our theory with respect to the coordinate systems which are going to give us back the world as we experience it. So how is this, if I can explain a little bit how this is. Earlier I talked about what sort of the basic features of the axiomatic method are, so how is what I've just said related to this? How's this all supposed to go? We work our way up from doing experiments and observations and things like that in physics to this conceptual structure, which Hilbert says one of the key axioms of that is going to be general covariance. Having done that, having got ourselves to the axioms, we then have to derive the logical consequences, and one of these, as we said, was theorem one, this underdetermination thing. And as I said then, okay, we're not done. Part of the axiomatic method is that we have to then look for any conflict that there might be between the consequences of our axioms and the world as we experience it. And he says, oh, but there is a problem here because we experience the world as being causally ordered and causally determinate, but that's not what you get from general covariance, so there seems to be some kind of conflict. How are we supposed to resolve this conflict? Well, we have to make use of proper coordinate systems. We have to, which he means we just have to do the kinds of things that we do anyway. We have to do some sort of gauge fixing or whatever in order to recover from our generally covariant theory predictions and things like this about the world as we experience it. So we have to do that. And then for Hilbert, the second part of what I was mentioning just now, this involves revising the Kantian conception of objectivity. So just to spell that out a little bit more, how Hilbert wants to make this work is to say that being represented in space and time remains a condition for a possible objective experience. So we experience the world as being in space and time, but this is no longer going to be a criterion for a possible objective physics, because general covariance is our criterion for that. Anything that's generally covariant, and general covariance is the tool by which we get our conceptual structure of the world, and it doesn't contain within it causality in the way that we experience it. This just has to do with our experience. So what are we supposed to make of all this? What's the central problem that's worrying Hilbert? So his concern seems to be, look, what's the connection between the world as it's thought by us, the generally covariant world equations of physics, and the world as it's experienced by us? And for Hilbert, the axiomatic method helps us to distinguish these two things and to find tensions between them, which we should then strive to resolve. So having distinguished them, once we distinguish the conceptual structure, the world as it's thought by us, from the world as it's experienced, we try to resolve tensions between these things, but still we're left with the question of, well, what's the applicability, what's the relationship between this conceptual structure that we've built and the world as we experience it? And he worries about this, and he says, look, in practice, what we're going to have to do is add what he calls accessorial laws, ways of connecting our theories in physics to our experience of the world. But he's pretty clear that no such accessorial law should really be needed. And I don't know how to go beyond this. So there's more in there that I haven't read, but there's a big volume that Tilman Sauer and Ulrich Meyer just published. There's a lot of work still to be done on what's going on with Hilbert's epistemology there, but that's about as far as I can get us. Okay, so we've seen how general covariance and causality are connected for Hilbert. It really is just this theorem one that was already there in the proofs of his first communication on the foundations of physics. We saw that in that case he took from Einstein and used energy conservation as a way of helping him to solve that problem, but that solution is not available once you've got the generally covariant field equations of Einstein. Now Einstein treats energy conservation there. So the question is, well, what happens to energy conservation in all this? We don't need extra equations to ensure energy conservation anymore, so maybe it just drops out. Well, it doesn't drop out for Hilbert. Instead, new puzzles arise. And here's the core of the new thing that Hilbert worries about with respect to energy conservation. So he says, well, there seems to be something very different between classical mechanics and generally covariant theories. The conservation laws look different, and in particular, in the case of classical mechanics, energy conservation is something that you only get via stipulation from the laws. So take your expression for energy, and then take the divergence of that expression, and it's only going to be set to zero by means of, you know, saying that this expression, the divergence of it, has to vanish according to the laws. And it doesn't seem to work that way in generally covariant theories, Hilbert worries. It seems to be the case that energy conservation holds identically, that is, without reference to the Lagrangian equations. Well, what could that mean? What's going on here? And as was mentioned earlier, this is where Klein and Hilbert ask Emmy Noether for assistance. They're trying to understand. They think there's something different about the status of energy conservation in generally covariant theories as compared to previous theories, and they're trying to guess at what it is. So here she is. Here's Emmy Noether. And in 1918, she publishes this paper that's best known for connections between symmetries and conservation laws. And there are two theorems in this paper, and the second one provides a general mathematical proof of the connections between general covariance, causality, in the Hilbert sense of underdetermination, and conservation of energy, and which shows how the status of energy conservation is affected by moving to a generally covariant theory. So here's what's in that 1918 paper that's relevant to this. So what she shows is that in non-generally covariant theories, as we said, the divergence of the energy expression vanishes as a consequence of the laws, exactly as Hilbert says. But in generally covariant theories, the situation is a little different. So the divergence of the energy expression vanishes just in virtue of the form of the energy expression. So given the form, just as a matter of mathematics, if you take its divergence, then it's going to vanish. And the reason it has this particular mathematical form comes about just because of the lack of independence among the field equations. So this is the causality issue. It rises as sort of the other face of the underdetermination issue, and this in turn is a consequence of the general covariance. So what you see from our second theorem is that given a generally covariant theory, the field equations, there are going to be dependencies among the field equations, and the form of those dependencies is going to be such that your energy expression or your expression for your associated conserved quantity is going to be such that, just as a matter of its structure, once you take the divergence, this thing vanishes, regard independently, as it were, of the, in some sense independently of the field equations. Here's what Einstein wrote when he had seen this paper. Yesterday I received from Miss Nurser a very interesting paper on invariance. I'm impressed that such things can be understood in such a general way. The old guard at Göttingen should take some lessons from Miss Nurser. She seems to know her stuff. And it's, yes, it's one of these beautiful papers that just sets specific things that people have been doing in a general context in a really beautiful way. Okay, so that's really all I wanted to do by way of setting out this story of what Hilbert's project was doing and just tracing the thread of the connections between general covariance, causality, and energy conservation from the time of Einstein's visit through to after that, so after, in the wake of the field equations. So I was focusing on this intersection between Einstein's work and Hilbert's work on physics that took place in 1915, and in particular Einstein's field equations. So I wanted to just trace the development of Hilbert's thinking on these three things and the relations between them, and just try and situate this in the context of his wider epistemological interest, to just try and give some flavour of the kinds of the way that he was thinking about physics at the time, and how this helps us to understand what was going on his own terms, rather than just thinking about it through sort of the lens of thinking about what Einstein was up to. And then I tried to give you some details of what changed in the wake of Einstein's field equations within his project and why. And as I said at the beginning, also to just kind of make explicit that, look, it's what's really interesting philosophically is the way that people theorize, the way they go about physical theorizing, the things that they draw on in order to try and get to where they're going with their theorizing, that's most revealing philosophically. And that's all.